Dr. Taylor Ryle is the real deal. She's an accomplished academic hepatobiliary surgeon, executive coach, competitive athlete, and a genuine inspiration to all who encounter her. Dr. Ryle was a major inspiration for me in my ongoing path to wellness and in the creation of this podcast. We tackle a lot in this discussion, but we start with changing surgical culture one surgeon, one inspiration at a time, and move to mindfulness and resilience. This podcast is titled Sitting with the Pieces, and that refers to the Japanese art of kintsugi, where pottery is intentionally broken and put back together with gold. The metaphor is incredibly strong. What once was broken can be beautiful and have form, and that we are all made of pieces that, when assembled, define who we are. Enjoy. My name is Phil Perazio, and I'm a urologic oncologist, a surgeon. Like many of you, I absolutely love what I do, and I would not choose another profession. But I have struggled with professional identity, practice efficiency, and wellness over the years. Operate with Zen is a podcast designed to explore a mindful approach to surgery and to being a surgeon. By discussing these struggles and mindful solutions, I hope together we can create a community of strong and healthy surgeons. Enjoy. Welcome to this episode of Operate with Zen. Today, I have the great pleasure of being joined by Dr. Taylor Ryle. Taylor, introduce yourself to the audience.
Hi, I'm Taylor Ryle. I am a surgeon at the University of Arizona. I do mostly pancreas and hepatobiliary surgery. In my life outside the hospital, I live in Marana, Arizona, which is outside of Tucson. I have a wonderful husband and two dogs, a four-year-old golden doodle and a one-year-old golden doodle, who are the center of my world. They've changed my life in a lot of positive ways. I love to run. I love to be active. My newest hobby is I've taken up boxing. So lots of things going on in my world, but that's the basics of who I am.
Well, it's wonderful. So just so the audience knows, you, I don't remember if I told you this before, but you were one of my inspirations on this wellness journey. And as I kind of started in thinking about these things and how to be better myself and how to be more mindful and productive, you were one of the first people I heard give a phenomenal talk. I think it was at the Society for Urologic Oncology. And it made me think, if she's up there as a really established academic surgeon and talking about this stuff, then we all should be talking about this and thinking about these things. So I just wanted to let you know that you are an important part of my journey and my inspiration for kind of ending up where I am today. So thank you for that.
Thank you. It makes it really worth sort of telling my story and going out there and talking about it. You know, I really, as I kind of made a transition in my personal life, my goal was to really change the way that we train surgeons and the way that we develop faculty and really start to develop the whole person. You know, as I think about medicine and surgery in 2022, there's a lot of things that really help us go the distance, but part of that is just being a balanced person and being able to feed all those parts of ourselves. And it's something I consciously teach our residents here in Arizona. It's something I share with my faculty, and I'm glad it made an impact for you in some way.
Well, thanks. Huge impact. But let's start at the beginning, wherever you think that may start. We both trained at Hopkins, a couple years apart, but the culture hadn't changed dramatically. Tell us a little bit about your training, how that started your path, and now where you are now and how you got there.
So I went to medical school at Hopkins, and when I applied for residency, I wanted nothing more than to train at Hopkins. And I guess I'll preface everything I'm going to say with, I wouldn't have traded that experience for anything in the world. You know, I got great training there. I'm always grateful for the time that I spent at Hopkins. And I look back on those days with great fondness in many, many ways. So I think one of the things about Hopkins is it really set me up. It really set me up for success in my career. And it was a different time. I joke about it. I say, I've always been on the wrong side of the 80-hour work week thing. So when I was an intern, I was like the first person in the operating room. I put in the Foley, I wrote the orders, you know, I transported the patient. And then when I became a chief was right when they instituted the 80-hour work week. So as the chief, I was the first person in the operating room. I put in the Foley, I wrote the orders, you know, now the residents have all these restrictions and I have to be there for the timeouts. I'm the first person in the operating room. I put in the Foley, you know, I was like, well, when is it my turn, you know, to not be first? So I joke about it. I say I was kind of always on the wrong side of that. And I trained in an era when we were on call every other night or every third night. I know that generations before me had it worse. But I also think as I reflect on what my residents do now, it's different. You know, we get patients out of the hospital so fast that the acuity of what's in the hospital is markedly different even from when I trained. And you know, they don't have 24-hour calls. They have this night float. But there was one night when our residents were on a retreat or something, and I held those pagers for like an hour. I thought I was going to lose my mind. You know, that I had so many pagers, they were like weighing down my waist and it was just going off nonstop. You don't know any of the people that well. And it was way more stressful than being on call every other night and knowing, you know, the patients that you had in the hospital. So I think the world has changed. I think training at Hopkins was a great experience. There were so many smart people around, you know, there was always somebody who knew the answer. So if I didn't know, there was somebody who knew, I just had to find them. And it was an incredibly stimulating environment. It set me up for success in academic surgery. It also set me up with a lot of expectations of what that meant for my future, which is probably one of the things I struggle with now as I contemplate what I want my future to look like, you know, tied to that traditional model and those expectations. But I think in modern day surgery, there's a lot of different paths to success in academic surgery that maybe weren't the model when I was training.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. And I think that's one of the really fun things I talk about now with junior faculty and, excuse me, even residents or fellows. What's the path you want to follow, right? We don't have to follow that traditional path. We can kind of carve out our own space and our own niche and you know, follow our true passions rather than where we think we need to be.
Yeah, I think so. I also think I read a really interesting book called So Good They Can't Ignore You. And in the book, it sort of talks about this idea of, you know, follow your passion is sort of bad advice. And the reason they say that is like, they say, because in the beginning, you actually don't know what your passion is, right? Like how can you just know? And so you go in and you try all these things, right? So I go through my life and there's all these things I'm good at. And in the beginning, you don't have the luxury to just say, hey, well, I only want to do this. You know, you don't have the capital or whatever to do it. But then when you get later in your career, when I have all this capital, you know, now I'm good at a lot of things, right? So, and you're being pulled in a lot of directions, but that's the time where you can kind of step back and say, you know what, this is really what I love. And this is really what I want to pursue. And so I tell people, try different things, because you may not know exactly what your passion is. You may have ideas, you may have directions, but all these things present themselves to you as you try them. And there's something I think about a fair amount.
I think that's great advice. And just kind of reflecting back and, you know, my own career, I think I've been very fortunate. You know, you say yes in the beginning to a lot of things. And you're right, as you gain capital and gain experience, you learn where to say no to make sure you're moving things in a direction you think you want to go in. And it ends up kind of getting more and more fine and precise, and you get more and more control as you do it. But I think that's great advice for people to hear, especially in the beginning of their careers.
Yeah. And on the flip side of that, you know, it's not as easy as I think to set boundaries, you know, to say, I'm not going to do that. You know, a good example is this year, you know, it's been a difficult year and I've been trying to cut down just on the amount I travel, and COVID did that for me sort of naturally, but it's sort of this break point. So now I'm like, hey, now I have this opportunity to not get back to like traveling as much as I was. And so I'm like, okay, I'm going to go to this meeting. I'm like, this year, I'm not going to go to the American College of Surgeons. I'm like, I'm not on the board of governors anymore. I'm not going to go. And then I've gotten like three invitations to come and talk about something. And it's like, it takes this great willpower to be like, thank you. I really appreciate the invitation. And this year I'm not able to travel, you know? And I always feel like I have to explain why. And then I realize, actually, you don't have to say the second part. You can just say, thank you. I can do it.
Yeah. It's really hard. One of the things I've found to maybe help a little bit is if you have a junior partner or somebody else, you know, is a rising star, to give them the opportunity, and it makes you feel a little less worse about saying no. Cause you know, we do this not cause we want the recognition, but because it's a chance to put forward the thoughts and the ideas and all of the things we've worked on and care so much about, but to know somebody else is going to do a job and a good job and give them the opportunity sometimes helps a little with the pain of saying no. So tell me about, let's talk a little bit about changing culture, and your residents are very different than the way we were trained, and residents were trained at Hopkins. Tell us now how you think about training residents. How do we make the best surgeons that we can? And, you know, how do we get there?
So I kind of came to the place that I am, and I've told this story in other venues, you know, through a personal experience with burnout in my surgical career. And it wasn't my situation. I had a great job. I was, you know, really well supported there, but basically stopped doing all the things that made me who I was. And I think what I've realized is that over time, your priorities change. Sometimes they change abruptly. Sometimes that change is a little more subtle, and you need to continually change, you know, with those priorities. And if you don't, I think you can wake up, you know, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, and say, I'm not doing what I want to do. And it's hard to change it. And so as I went through that transition, I met a sports psychologist who really talked to me a lot about mindfulness, but more about saying, like, I get to choose, you know, what my life is like. Like, I can create the life I want instead of just believe I have to settle for the life that I have. And in every moment I have a choice. You know, they're not easy choices, but I get to choose how I respond to my circumstances, what I do. And if I want to change it, that may not be easy, but I can do that. And so it's something I've sort of taken with me, and I wanted to do what he did. I became an executive coach. My initial thought was to leave medicine and to coach people who felt like I did. But I thought, gosh, you know, I have this unique opportunity. You know, my perspective changed. And I said, I have this unique opportunity to change the way that we train surgeons and to use my leadership positions locally and nationally to influence that culture. And so when I came to Arizona, I started a program for my residents. It's a well-being and resiliency program. But I really think, just like our responsibility to teach young surgeons to operate and to do surgical decision-making and all those things, I think we have an obligation to teach them the skills that actually are critically important to success in the complex matrixed environments that we all work in, you know, things like emotional intelligence and communication skills and these soft skills that nobody taught me when I was a resident. You know, we just would go through and it was like scorched earth behind us. Right? And it's not like I was wrong, you know, but I don't know, maybe there was a better way I could have communicated it. So I think those skills can't be underestimated. And when I think about what helps me succeed as a leader, it's really those things. I mean, I need to be a competent surgeon. I need to be in the OR and doing those things, but it's really those skills that makes me successful. And so I feel like I want my residents to walk away with that. I feel like I've changed the trajectory of this department, and I feel like my residents go out and they change the trajectory of the next lives that they touch. And you can't change it all overnight, but it, you know, it's like a ripple effect.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And, you know, I'm being a little bit facetious, but you think back to training, and sometimes you feel like you were taught the wrong kind of skills, the wrong communication skills. I mean, some of the ways we behaved were not appropriate, and they were not necessarily encouraged, but they weren't discouraged either. And in retrospect, I wish I had behaved very differently at some points in my life and some points of my training. And so now instead of just letting it be, I try to actively take a part with the residents and the trainees and say, let me help you with this conversation. How do you think this is going to go? How do you think you can, you know, interact with this person? What is it that you both want out of this conversation rather than just, yeah, you could stomp your fist and your feet and, you know, make a whole big scene, but it's probably not the most effective way to get done what you want to get done.
Yeah. It's not only that, it's like, you know, how we communicate with each other, but then also this surgical culture that's so inbred in all of us. And this is one thing I would say, you know, at Hopkins, especially in probably in other programs at that time, but it's just this culture of strength, you know, and like not never being vulnerable, like never letting people see you upset. And I've come to think a lot about that, but we all have challenges and pivot points in our lives. And on a day-to-day basis, we have complications in the OR and things that sort of affect us. And Hopkins, we're just like, hey, you know, pain is weakness leaving the body, you know, and you're just like, there was just no, like you, nobody wanted to be weak, you know, like whatever that meant. And, you know, I really want to create an environment here where people can come forward and they can get help. And I've had several situations of residents or faculty coming up with real challenges in their lives that, you know, instead of letting it destroy their career, we were able to help them and put them on the right path early. And if I can do that for one person, then what I do makes a difference.
Yeah, I think that's huge. And I just want to say, this isn't, we're not bashing on Hopkins specifically. We could take out that name and we could fill it in with any number of kind of excellent classic surgical programs around the country. Just that
it
we
was
both,
a different time.
Yeah.
It was a totally different time. And that generation before us sacrificed, I mean, so much and so much of their personal lives to do that. And it was the best model of professionalism that they knew. And they always put the patients first. You know, there was so much to that. And I admire all my mentors from that generation. They're incredible people.
Yeah, I agree completely. And I think it's a really nice transition to say, I mean, we still can put the patient first by putting ourselves first and making sure that we're addressing kind of who we need to be and giving ourselves a good foundation to be excellent surgeons and excellent clinicians and excellent colleagues. And, you know, one of the things I've worked on is really the way I start every day is with a focus, an intentional focus on having a productive day and being a good person and being kind and being really good at what I do. And it sets the tone for the morning and it sets the tone for the whole day. And it makes a difference.
I think if we don't take care of ourselves, then actually we can't take care of anybody. You know, when I think of myself and my most burned out, I didn't have the energy to take care of anyone else. And then you're sort of out of the game, right? And I saw my mentors, like they were there every day, you know, they would round every day. And when I started my career, I used to think I'm the only person who can take care of my patients, but I'm not, you know, and I used to think, well, the patients aren't going to like that, but actually they understand. And if you just set that expectation and you're like, hey, you know, I'm not going to be here this weekend. My partner is going to take care of you. And I have not had one patient who feels like I've offered them less than, you know, when I'm there every day. And I think part of the culture we're trying to create here is really forming cohesive teams. So I have two hepatobiliary partners and we're getting a fourth person on that team, but we're interchangeable. You know, if somebody's on call, if they call me, I'm like, hey, yeah, we're happy to take care of that patient. You know, I'm not on call, but my partners will take care of it. And we're not sort of possessive about patients and we take care of each other's things. And it makes a huge difference. So I think you can provide very good care. It's just a very different model from what I learned. And it doesn't sacrifice patient care. People think that when I go and talk about this in some places, they're like, well, if you're just talking about well-being and whatever, nobody's going to work hard. And it's actually just the opposite. Cause I think when people are healthy and they're engaged, they have the discretional energy to do all those things, work RVUs, quality, patient satisfaction, whatever it is, because they're there and they have that energy to do it. And I see just the opposite. When people feel like you treat them well and they feel valued, they will go the extra mile.
I agree with you completely. I think that's a great way of putting it, is the discretionary energy. And I always say, you know, wellness is the foundation. If you feel physically well, if you're eating right, if you have a reasonable amount of sleep, if you're doing things to create a foundation, you have discretionary energy, as you put it, to be able to work on all of the other things, your clinical practice, your academic practice, your relationships. You have that energy. Whereas if you're zapped and have nothing, it all kind of falls apart. And I think the last thing I would say is, you know, you talked about kind of burnout and really struggling with that a little bit. And I think the data shows that too, right? We struggle. We make mistakes when we're burnt out, when we don't have that energy. I mean, bad things actually can happen to ourselves, to our patients. And so really taking care of ourselves not only enables good care, but prevents bad care from happening and prevents mistakes from happening.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I think it's essential to high quality patient care. And, you know, I know it's challenging. I haven't got the sleep thing figured out yet.
Sleep's a tough one.
Sleep, yeah, I have a 25-year sleep deficit. Right. It's relatively irreversible.
Well, I think part of that is recognizing, right, you don't need that much sleep. And different people have different sleep needs. And, you know, we all kind of figure out our individual.
And I need more as I get older.
fair point, too. Let's talk about the residents a little more too, you know, kind of specifics. Is there a curriculum? Do you meet on a regular basis? How do you work? How do you teach people to be well?
So we do have a curriculum. I meet with the residents once a month for a 2-hour session. We do it during their protected educational time. And it's required, you know, but it doesn't take time away from the rest of their day. We also have events that we have all the time that are optional that residents can participate in or not. You know, I try to have a variety of activities because I recognize that not everybody thinks it's fun to run 13 miles, but you know, we'll run races, we'll have yoga and brunch, we'll do book clubs, we'll go to hockey games, whatever that really appeals to families, to all different aspects of them. But the formal curriculum is based on a model I learned in my coaching called energy leadership. But basically it's a model that helps teach emotional intelligence and self-awareness. And you don't have to use that model. There's lots of different models that you can use, but it just sort of starts the conversation. It creates a language and foundation for us to talk about the interactions that people have and different things. And then we have a formal curriculum that talks about work-life integration, talks about resilience, about strategic diet and exercise, ergonomics, you know, any aspect that you can think of. I'll also be open to topics that the residents want to learn about. You know, I had a resident who came to me, gosh, he's graduated now, probably 4 years ago, but he showed me a video on that had touched him on kintsugi. I don't know if you know what that is, but it's a Japanese art form where it's a very introspective process. And you take a piece of pottery and you basically wrap that pottery in cloth and you break it. And it's symbolic of the hammers in our lives and the things that hold us together during those times. And then that is in a very elaborate process is sort of put back together with this gold leaf filler. And that end product is beautiful and strong in its own right. And so there's a woman who had a video on this process and we actually had a whole session around resilience, and we had faculty who came and told their own stories of resilience. And I invited people to come and talk, you know, I had no idea what people would say. And it was just eye-opening, like hearing what different people were dealing with in the present or had dealt with in the past, and recognizing that you're not alone, you know, in these struggles that you have. And we actually had that person come and we did the process, which was incredibly valuable for me as I navigate some of my own challenges right now. I think a lot about that because the surgeons were kind of good at, you know, we're good at sort of putting the pieces back together and hoping that nobody notices it was broken, but we're not really good at the part about sitting with the pieces and kind of deciding which pieces fit and which don't, you know, as we move forward and in different parts of our lives. But we'll do all kinds of sessions like that. Anything that the residents bring forward, we'll try. Some things work, some things don't. I do have a curriculum for certain sessions that can be exported, but that's the format.
Very cool. But if you don't mind getting into it, I mean, you have had some health issues over the past year, and resilience has been a big part of this. If you wouldn't mind sharing, you know, with the audience a little bit, tell us a little more of your story.
Yeah, this last year has been quite a year. So I was diagnosed with lung cancer in June of last year. So it's been just about a year since I had surgery. I had my left upper lobe removed. This is kind of a shock to me because I'm healthy. I run all the time. I'm a non-smoker, you know, so I think of all the kinds of cancer you could tell me I had, I would have said lung cancer, really? I joke about it. I say I'm going to start smoking and drinking, but I'm still in the pre-contemplative phase. But, you know, so that was sort of one thing. It's interesting. It wasn't actually the worst part of my year. So when that's not the worst part of your year, it's a pretty bad year. But at the same time, like, I had been the interim chair of this department in Arizona for 2 years, you know, and they launched the chair search right in the middle of my lung cancer diagnosis. And I was literally recovering from surgery when I interviewed, you know, officially for that position. And, you know, and they chose a very talented person to take the role of chair. Certainly a different value proposition than what I offered in the department. And it really makes me kind of step back and think about the things I was talking about, thinking about resiliency. And, you know, maybe I'm in one of those phases of my life where I'm sort of sitting with the pieces, right? And deciding what I want it to look like, how I want to put them back together. But as a person who treats cancer, it gives me like a little bit different perspective on what my patients are dealing with. And as I think about what my life looks like moving forward, I think, what are the things that are important to me? You know, I've been raised to be a chair since I'm like, you know, an intern. If you talk to Dr. Cameron, he'd say, everybody wants to be a chair. I'd be like, well, I don't know. You know, I just don't know right now if that's the direction I want to go. There's lots of things I love in Arizona. There's lots of stuff that I've built here that's important to me. I love my life here. You know, do I want to trade that for something else? And so those are just things I think about, but it's certainly been, when I think about 6 years ago, I think I could never have dealt with all that I've dealt with in the last year without the skill set that I have. And so if I can look at it in a positive way, I guess I would say that, but certainly it's been a challenging year.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. Do you have an objective process for kind of dealing with challenges or dealing with these issues? Do you have something you take yourself through when things are tough?
It's interesting. I have a coach, you know, I work as a coach, and it's really easy for me to help other people sort through this, but it's not as easy to do that for myself because I think you're just too entangled in it. Right. So it helps to have a coach sort of walk me through that process and help me clarify what's important to me and help me set down those things that are not important to me. And that's not always easy to do. I would say I'm still doing that. You know, it's just really sort of navigating that process, and it's okay. You know, as I kind of go through that, I think, well, what are the things, like right now, I think, well, what are the things that make me feel whole, or what are the things I want to feel in my life? And instead of waiting till some magic time to have that, I say, like, well, how can I get that now? So just for example, things I've started doing in the last few months, really, my dog Winston, he's 4 and he's just a wonderful animal, but I got him certified to be a therapy dog. And I bring him to work. I bring him to the operating room and I bring him to see the nurses and see the patients. And at a time when everybody's so overworked and understaffed and stressed by COVID, it's just something that brings me incredible joy. Like, people see him and they just light up and it like changes their day. The dog loves it because he loves attention and it just brings me joy. And my husband says, you know, you're going to add that to your day? I'm like, but it's not adding it. It's just something that like really brings me joy and it feeds like my sense of connection right now. Then I started boxing. I told you that in the beginning, but part of that is like between being sick and the events of this last year, like I want something that makes me feel strong, right? And it's great for that. You know, I started doing it and I was like, I'm never going to box with somebody else. But now I'm like, I want to spar. You know, I asked my surgeon, is it okay for me to spar? He's like, I can honestly say I've never been asked that a year after major lung surgery. But I just try to find those things in my life. I have a really good friend who is really changing her life and she just started running, and somehow I can be an inspiration to her. You know, I ran a half marathon with her and helped her finish in her goal time. And it's just like different things that make me feel whole. And so I just hold on to those things and they change, and maybe it'll be something different next month or next year, but that's how I navigate it.
I think that's pretty incredible. I don't know. Did you ever read Total Leadership, Stuart Friedman? I mean, I just think what you've just described is a beautiful example of kind of the theory put forth in that book. The more we can align the things we love, whether they're kind of our work life, our home life, our community, you know, our other interests, the more, as you said, the discretional energy, the more energy you have, the way that makes you feel, you know, you're aligning these interests and the things you love. And it's fulfilling, and you can see the joy on your face sitting here talking with you. So it's exciting.
Yeah. He talks about that concept of the four-way wins. And it's like, if my dog makes me happy, you know, he brings me that peace at home, and then I can bring that here. Right. And it overlaps with my work life. And you know, the more that you can do that, it's kind of it's a simple concept, but it's actually not that easy.
Yeah. It's definitely not that easy, but it's fun to think about these things and work on them. So I boxed during my lab year during residency, and for a little bit longer than that. I mean, it is hands down the best
exercise.
I mean, you just try and dance your feet around for 3 minutes at a time, and then, you know, shadow box for 3 minutes at a time. I mean, you are exhausted at the end of a boxing workout. And that was a really fun workout. I think an incredibly mindful practice in terms of sports practice, because you have to be so keyed in on exactly what you're doing and exactly who your opponent is and what they're doing. It's a phenomenal practice. I wouldn't necessarily recommend that surgeons go around punching hard things and getting hit in the head on a routine basis, but the boxing workouts I would certainly endorse along with you.
I figure I'm going to spar with like 50-year-old, 100-pound women who are as bad as I am. So I probably can't get hurt. But I thought, you know, people think it's like, get out your aggression. And I do like that part of it, but it's more like the strategy of it and learning defense. And it's pretty interesting. I never knew much about boxing, but I like it a lot. And it is a great workout.
Yeah. I love the simplest part of it. I mean, if you break it down, it's simplest, it's hit and don't get hit.
Right.
So how can you make your body and your target zones as small as possible by being able to be balanced and strike back at somebody else? I mean, it's.
And how do you see that split second opening? You know, how do you, you know, part of that, it's like, again, being in the moment and not being in your head, you know, because like one of the things that's interesting is like, they'll teach you patterns and like, you know, hey, if you slip back, you know, then you can come back with your two or like whatever that is. But you have to be able to, it has to be automatic, and you have to just be in that moment and not be thinking, well, I'm going to throw this combination of punches or this. Like, you have to be totally responsive, which is why sparring is interesting.
Absolutely. So, good segue. Do you have a mindfulness practice?
I do. You know, I do meditation. I'm not a terribly good passive meditator because I fall asleep, but I do what I consider active meditations. And I really try to focus on like what I'm doing it while I'm doing it. So I used to be very proud of my ability to multitask, but I find that when I do, I'm actually not very good at anything. So I try to focus on what I'm doing while I'm doing it. So if I'm running, I try to focus on my footsteps or sort of be in that moment. If I am eating, try to just taste my food, even if I just stop for 5 minutes, but not answering emails while I'm doing that. Try to manage my email and kind of sit down at times a day to do that, because that can be a constant distractor for me. If I am walking, you know, from my office to the operating room, I just try to see people and say hello and do that. I think one of the things I love about the therapy dog thing is that it's something I do that puts me in the moment, you know, because I can just sort of interact with people and be with them and see their joy. So I'm not worried about what else I have to do.
No, that's great. And I think it, just to bring home for the audience, mindfulness takes all forms of shapes and practices. And listen, nobody's great at it. That's why it's a practice, right? We work at it and we find what works for us. And it's really about, you know, finding what helps you be present, helps you be focused and clearing your mind. I remember, I'm not the distance runner you are at all, Taylor, but I ran the New York City Marathon twice when I was in med school. And my favorite parts of those long practice runs where you'd get somewhere 45 minutes, an hour in, and your mind just went clear. You know, I just felt like you were incredibly present. And at that point in my life, I had no idea what I was doing. I didn't recognize what was going on. But now that mindfulness is part of my routine, in retrospect, I go, oh man, I was there. That's probably the most mindful I ever was in my life, were in those moments on those long runs where you could just be in the run. And it's been, I've been kind of striving to achieve that while sitting, while practicing, while doing other things. And I think it's important to recognize that active mindfulness is a very valid form of practice.
How do you do it?
Every morning I wake up, I do very brief yoga, usually 20 minutes or 30 minutes, just depending if I'm operating or not. And then I will sit and do 5 minutes, usually of a guided meditation in the morning. I'm a little too ADD and anxious about the OR in the day to kind of just sit in silence or try and do that. But that's usually where I set an intention and kind of focus on what I want to do for the day. And then at night, I will try and sit down for another. I try longer, but I'm like you, when I'm really quiet, I'll fall asleep while meditating. But that's not a bad way to do it either, to be honest with you. And just try and sit for 10 to 15 minutes. And that's where I try and a non-guided meditation and sit there myself and see what I can, see if I can get out of my, you know, kind of my default state mode and just kind of clear my mind and try and, you know, let the wandering cease and focus on my breathing. So that's my current practice and it'll evolve.
Yeah. My superpower is I can sleep anywhere, anytime, but I don't know, the meditation and mindfulness takes a lot of different forms, as you point out. And, you know, you sort of talk about setting your intention through a formal meditation or whatever, but I kind of go through a process where it's like really easy for me to come home at the end of the day and say, I didn't get anything done. And, you know, my to-do list is way too long and not practical. And it's easy to feel like you failed. So I have a practice where I just set my intention in the sense that I say, you know, these are the one or two things that are really important today. If I get other things done, that's great. But like, what is really important? So I would set myself up to fail on a day when I had a lot of cases in the OR, if I have this long to-do list and then I didn't get to it, you know? So now I'm like, hey, you know, this is my Thursday in the OR and my job is to teach the residents and to do the best operations I can do. And then if I get anything else done, that's great. But just really being conscious about focusing that intention, and it's maybe not always a spiritual practice, but it's just a very focused, like, and it helps me not feel like I didn't get things done in a given day. And I've become okay with the idea that I'm going to die and there's still going to be things on my to-do list. So I'm never going to finish it.
Yeah. That to-do list always grows, as does our epic inbox. Doesn't matter if you clear it today, it'll be there tomorrow. So don't drive yourself crazy. You know, do the best you can. And I think it's important to, like, obviously we have priorities, we have things that need to be done, but identifying them instead of just being a slave to the to-do list, I think is, you know, an important statement. We've talked about a lot of things. One of my favorite parts of your talk always is when you get into your dogs a lot, and you bring great comparisons and analogies to kind of a dog's life and mindfulness practices or being present. So bring us up to speed on the dogs. Tell us, you know, what's going on and how that helps keep you grounded.
Yeah, I have two, you know, Winston's 4 and Dakota's 1. You get one soul dog in every life and Winston is mine. I love Dakota too, but Winston's my soul dog. And he teaches me a lot of things. Like, and I say that one of the things he teaches me is how to live in the moment. You know, it's easier for him because his calendar is certainly not as packed as mine, but Winston just lives in the moment. You know, I always tell the story when we went to Africa, we dropped Winston off at the Tucson Adventure Dog Ranch. You can't make this stuff up, but the dog's like, it's like dog camp, you know, and he plays every day and they don't sleep in crates and they go swimming and hiking and all this stuff. And they send you pictures every day. And when we were coming home to pick him up, you know, I missed him so much. And I said to Charlie, I was like, do you think he's going to be sad to leave the dog ranch? And I realized, like, he's not sad to leave the dog ranch. Like, he wakes up there every day. He's like, this is so great, you know? And then when he sees me, he's like so excited. His whole body's wagging and he doesn't leave and think like, oh, I don't want to leave here. Or like, when am I going to come back? Like, he doesn't regret. He doesn't anticipate. He's just like, great. You know, I can get up at like 3 a.m. and stumble out to the car. And he's like, where are we going? You know, he's like, this is my favorite. And it doesn't matter. Like, he's just up for like whatever thing we do. And, you know, I mean, I obviously don't do it as well as he does, but like, I learned from that. You know, I think the other thing I learned from Winston is that empathy doesn't require like having experienced what somebody else experienced. It only has to do with connecting with the emotions, because dogs can do empathy in a way that humans can't. So when I'm sad, you know, Winston just knows, you know, and he's there with me. He'll just lay down with me and he'll put his head on my chest or whatever. And he's like, hey, mom, I'm just there with you. You know, he doesn't try to solve it. He doesn't tell me, you know, it'll get better. He doesn't tell me about a time he had it worse. Like, he just is sort of there with you. And I think sometimes maybe that's what my patients need, right? They don't need me to tell them they'll feel better or this complication will get better. They just need me to sit there and listen or whatever. So he teaches me tons of things. And you know, my next life, I'm going to be my dog.
We should all hope. I mean, what incredible beings they are. So we've talked a bunch about kind of changing culture and making things better. And I think one of the ways to do that is kind of through coaching. And I was certified as a coach, and one of the things that's made me is a much better listener. Right. And what's really interesting about coaching versus mentoring, and I'd love to hear your take on it a second, is that, you know, you're not often presenting the solutions. There's sometimes where somebody just needs an answer, but most of the time you're listening and helping that person come to their own answers. And that's the coach's role, is bringing the best out of that person. And I think that's one of the ways we can change surgical culture, is by listening to each other and trying to get the most out of whether it's our peers, our colleagues, our trainees, instead of always telling them the way it should be done. So I'd love to hear your philosophies and thoughts on coaching and kind of how you impart it now.
I think if you just incorporated basic coaching skills like into your day-to-day life, things would be different. You know, I talk about acknowledging and validating people's feelings, right? It's active listening. It's asking open-ended questions, right? Trying to understand other people's perspectives. And I mean, those are just very basic coaching skills that they teach every coach. And if we just use that more in our day-to-day interactions, like, we would learn so much, you know? So when someone comes at me and they're really angry, you know, if I, in that moment, I can stop, and instead of responding reflexively to that, if I can be curious, you know, if I can step back and say, hey, you know, what is it that I've done, or what about this situation has triggered this, you know, curious in a truly curious way, not like, you know, why are you acting that way, without judgment. You know, I'm pretty good at judgment. So it's something I work on all the time. I try to switch that to curiosity. And, you know, some days I'm better at it than others, for sure. Like you said, it's a practice. I'm never going to wake up and be like, hey, I got this. I just wake up and try to be the best me I can be every day. But, you know, if we could just bring those skills to the way that we interact with everybody, whether that's at the gas station or in the OR or, you know, on the floors, or when the operator calls you or whatever that is, you know, just seeing that other perspective and stopping, and like you said, being kind and just treating other people like humans.
Yeah. I tell you, the one part, one area in my life, it's backfired a little bit. Now, as my wife is on to me and she's like, do not coach me.
I know. She's like, I say that all the time. I'm like, do not acknowledge and validate what I'm thinking. Yeah. I was like, I know what you're doing.
Yeah. So, yeah, she's on to me. So, but it has made me a better listener. And I know she appreciates that. It's definitely made me a better listener. So we're getting close to our time. I want to give you the opportunity. Is there anything else you want to talk about? Anything you want to, let the audience know that we should be talking about?
Phil, I think, like you said, I think this is a journey, right? And like I said, every day I just wake up and I try to be the best me I can be. Some days that's better than others. Some situations is better than others. And it's okay. Like, it's okay to go through bad times and to feel frustrated and to do that. We all experience that. And it's really important to create the support system around you and be able to be vulnerable and talk about that and have people help you. But people are willing to help you if you're willing to listen. And I really do believe that we have to take care of ourselves to take care of our patients. And I hope people walk away with that message and also understand that there's lots of different forms that takes. And what works for me may not work for somebody else, but it's about finding those things in whatever that time is that fulfill you, that bring you joy, that bring you peace.
I think that's a wonderful message. There is one more specific question that's kind of come up and that I would like to ask you. We talked about training the next generation, bringing along people. You are an incredible example of an academic surgeon, but a woman academic surgeon in addition. And is it different for how you train and bring about the next generation of strong women surgeons? Because there are certainly different stresses, potentially additional stresses. And I would just love to hear your take and, inspiration for the next generation coming up.
Yeah, I want to bring along all the next generation, not just women, but I used to think it didn't matter. I used to think it's all the same. And most of my mentors were men, right? I just trained in a different era. But I have sort of come to realize that that women are different. Like, we respond differently in different situations. And I want to give women that confidence to pursue the things that they want. For example, if there's a job posted and there's 10 requirements, if a woman has 9, she won't apply. If a guy has like 3, he'll apply. So yeah, and it's just a little bit of a different way that women approach things. And so, I work with women all the time to give them the confidence to define what success looks like for them and to help balance some of the unique challenges that is for women. I don't have children, so that is something I haven't experienced firsthand, but you can do it. I think one of the beautiful things about surgery is that there's so many different careers you could forge in surgery that can allow you to do all those things. There's a whole range of things that are purely elective practices to things that are like transplant, where you're on call all the time, and you can really create the life that you want. And so I want everybody to understand that you can actually create that life that you want and you don't have to settle.
Perfect. Wonderful, wonderful answer. So I'll just take the opportunity to kind of summarize a little bit here. And I think one of the great themes over our conversation over the last hour was sitting with the pieces, right? Life isn't always perfect and sometimes it's going to feel a little broken, but we can put it back together, and putting it back together is just as beautiful as when it's whole. And what I also love, or another way that analogy fits, is that there are pieces of our lives and pieces of who we are that can also fit together, right? Today, we talked about dogs. We talked about boxing. We talked about mindfulness. We talked about energy leadership. We talked about coaching. And all of these pieces fit into the sense of whole of who we are and how we can kind of move forward as better, more thoughtful, more mindful surgeons to deliver, great care to our patients, to take good care of each other, and to make the profession and the career as wonderful as it can be.
There's a lot to love in a surgical career, and there's just a lot that we have to offer, and we can offer that better when we take care of ourselves.
It's a great message to sign off on. Taylor, thank you so much for spending time. I know there's a lot of people who are going to benefit from this conversation. So thank you for sharing with us.
Take care.
Thank you.